Let's get up to date on what happened on Capitol Hill and the demonstrations there. We had a brief moment of tension at the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone late yesterday as Seattle police returned to the East Precinct to scope it out. And the SPD has also walked back claims of extortion by armed demonstrators in the area. Here's the report from Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott.
In response to the death of George Floyd and to call for an end to systemic racism, both here in Washington state and across the country, a statewide general strike being called for today, as well as a protest and silent march planned by Black Lives Matter, Seattle and King County.
As we know, this is a silent march, and we have done that for a couple reasons on a more health focus level. This is to still decrease the risk of transmission for COVID-19 between folks. But also, it's really a silent march because we want this to be a moment to honor and hold space and mourn those who have lost their lives to police brutality and institutional racism in this country. This movement is to get justice for those who have unjustly lost their lives. So we want to hold space for that. For this event,
the group's Ebony Miranda says they're calling on everyone to try their best to maintain a 6-foot social distancing during the march, as well as bring gloves to wear and face masks. Here's how they want things to go.
We're really emphasizing that this is a Black-led march, that Black youth and Black people are at the front of this march leading it. And so we will be asking folks as we are gathering at Judkins Park before we start marching to allow room for Black folks to get to the front. And then we ask our POC allies to join behind us and then white allies behind that in a progressive stack type motion. And if you're riding a bike, you can ride behind the march and support us that way as well. So that is our intention as we are here having a statewide action for Black lives, that we really honor those and prioritize that.
The local event starts at 1 p.m. at Judkins Park, with the march taking off at 2 towards Jefferson Park, where speakers will make some closing remarks. Meantime, in the area, some are now calling the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone. Some clarity on rumors about protesters extorting businesses for protection money. I got a chance to ask Seattle Police Chief Carmen Best about that.
Can you speak to any legitimate reports where there's been evidence found of people with arms extorting businesses or residents in the what's now known as the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone?
We had heard through folks anecdotally that these things were occurring. Chief Nolet, who's also here today, gave a press conference and asked if anybody actually experienced that and reported it, then we would make sure that we taken a report. We haven't had any formal reports of this occurring other than people, you know, people have mentioned it through news media, social media posts, but no one's come forward for a police report. So if that does happen, we are encouraging people, if they've experienced that, to please notify us and we can follow up on it. But that has not happened affirmatively.
Mayor Durkin added,
my understanding is that there have been some occasions of some property damage, vandalism, a fight, but there's not been any serious incidents that have been documented.
Mayor Durkin making it clear yesterday that despite President Trump's Twitter threats that there would be no invasion of the Seattle area because of the actions of protesters.
Clearly, unfortunately, our president wants to tell a story about domestic terrorists who have a radical agenda and are promoting a conspiracy and fits his law and order initiatives. It's simply not true. The threat to invade Seattle, to divide and incite violence in our city, is not only unwelcome, it would be illegal.
But what is the plan up at the East Precinct?
We're trying to do things in a way that is responsible and that addresses the real life situation on the ground. And as everyone has seen over this last week, that when police do their jobs, it is often it is never a static situation. And so the chief of police working together with the rest of the departments is going to come up with an operational plan that we can make sure that we move forward appropriately.
Around 6 last night, several of the officers returned to the East Precinct and things got a little tense with protesters for a few short moments. In the end, things seemed to calm down and things went as usual last night. With more speakers at a town hall in the area now known as Chaz, people gathered again and listened to stories, had their chance at the megaphone to say what their interests were. Listening to some folks, it was clear that there are concerns about whether this message is being co-opted by some or distracting from the overall call to end systemic racism.
The only way that change is going to happen, everybody got to put the cards out on the table. If you want, y'all want change, they want change. But how do we make that happen, tearing folks? Innocent people who own these businesses and whatever and whatnot, they didn't ask for this.
Sky Radio's Hannah Scott. So what is it like to live in the autonomous zone? There are a lot of apartments around there, and given that this has become a round-the-clock thing, it could get noisy. And Colleen, you know someone who lives in the area.
That's right, quite noisy. We heard a little bit of that in Hannah's report. And my friend, who's also a producer at New Day Northwest, he lives in an apartment that is part of Chaz now. Right. He was just sitting in his apartment. One day he was in Capitol Hill. The next day he was in Chaz. And this is frequent outside of his window at, you know, 6 p.m. last night. So, yeah, it gets noisy. But he notes that it's more peaceful and less noisy than when there was a standoff between police and protesters and flashbangs, which is randomly
tear gas in the air.
Right. Right. Exactly. So, what happened for him is that he suddenly became part of Chaz, and here's what he thinks about it.
The South Barricade is right in front of my bedroom window, so protesters would be chanting there, taunting police, and just total chaos. No one wants to live like that, and, you know, fortunately the day after that is when police decided to move out of the area, and it's been basically, from my perspective, totally peaceful ever since then.
Peaceful, but different, like he needs permission to leave his apartment.
Our building management emailed us and told us that we have to get a sign printed by them to put in our windshield so that when we get to the gate, they're like, oh, okay, you live in here, you can come and go.
Who is they, though?
You know, that's a great question. I mean, it looks like I'm looking at the entry point right now. Sometimes they, whoever they are, they have a car parked there that they'll move in and out to let people through. Sometimes it's just a, like right now, it's just a person standing there, I think, just checking to see who the people are. So,
and is this building management setting this person up, or are these the formers of the Chaz?
Yeah, it's whoever is running this Chaz thing. And I feel like we kind of just have to go along with whatever these Chaz people are telling us to do.
For now, Joseph says he's just happy things are calm, that when police, again, were there, the situation was scary. But now it's just kind of quirky and weird for now. But he's closely watching.
I think people would tell me, you know, if I was to complain about it, Black people have had to live with fear in their lives forever. And if I can't live with this for like 5 minutes, I don't know. It's just kind of an eye-opening experience all around.
Yeah. This isn't necessarily being run by Black people from what I've seen. There's a bunch of organizations who are sort of asserting authority. And if you buy into the idea that government works with the consent of the people, there's a lot of people in that area who probably don't consent to this. So, I mean, did you get any feel
Maybe.
For...
This is just one person.
Well, that's what I mean. That's what I'm trying to figure out. He seems like, like you're saying, he's cool. How patient is he willing to be? If this becomes, I mean, so it's gone on for, what, week and a half now?
Right. Well, Joseph's a really patient person. You know, he was an interesting one for me to interview because I know he'll just be honest about it and not be too excited about, you know, well, this, what about my rent or this and that? He just goes, okay, this is what's happening. I'm looking around, figuring out how this impacts me. You know, but again, he's watching closely because something's going to come to a head. We know that. We don't know how it's going to happen or why, but it has to, because you see the city and police chief saying we cannot have this go on forever. We're happy it's peaceful. But the protesters are saying, listen, until there is reform, or what they would call defunding the police, this is what's going to happen. We're demanding a change.
Yeah. Okay, well, I would say that for the people who are residents in the area, we'd like to hear from you and find out just... how long is your fuse?
Right.
Maybe you're cool with it, and if it lasts forever, that's fine. But if it's caused an inconvenience, and there are people who are worried about the police response time.
I want to talk to somebody with kids, because let me tell you, if those protesters wake up my baby from a nap, that's when I'm unhappy.
Exactly.
But again, the this isn't to say that the reason they're out there is not worthy. But yes, I understand that for some people, this could be an inconvenience.
There are people who are sympathetic to the cause who are still worried about the police response time.
Yeah.
That's what I've learned.
Yeah.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. And we continue the discussion that has been opened up by the George Floyd incident, and that is, can you just reform the police department, or do you have to reform the entire society? Edwin Lindo has talked about this. He is an instructor at UW Medicine. Why don't you just describe what your role is there for everybody, Edwin?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm a critical race theory scholar, legally trained, went to law school, but have brought my theory and expertise to medicine because what we found is that medical students, trainees, and physicians need and want the skill to be able to treat not just the illnesses and issues that they see in their patients in the clinics, but what is affecting their patients outside of the clinics. And so I teach about justice, racial theory, racism, oppression, and how that has an undue influence and impact in the disproportionate harm caused to our patients.
You also do a podcast called The Praxis. And one of the statements you made was that Black and brown people continue to live in a system that literally kills them. So explain what you mean by that.
Yeah, and that's a statement that runs deep. It's not just true on face. It's true in the way that our systems operate on a daily basis. So let's look at COVID-19, for example. COVID-19, many who have seen the news see that there's a disproportionality of both transmission of the disease and mortality on Black and brown folks and indigenous Alaska Native folks here in the United States. That was a creation of a legacy of unemployment, of lack of access to good education, of forced segregation based on racial lines. We take Seattle, for example. Hopefully most people are aware of this history, but in Seattle, there was state-sanctioned redlining, which means north of Madison, Black folks couldn't buy homes, they couldn't live, and they couldn't operate there. And it wasn't just because people didn't like them. It was entrenched into the mechanisms of law and home buying. So if you were to look at a grand deed, I have a colleague who showed me his grand deed in 2020 that had the legacy language that said this home cannot be sold to a Mongol, a Black, or a Jew. Well, that forced segregation, if we look at the map of Seattle and King County, most Black and brown folks live south of Madison. And also, where do we have the highest rates of respiratory disease? Is south of Madison. And what is one of the leading causes of death if you are to contract COVID-19? Respiratory disease. All right, so there's a direct link to the racial segregation, the racial violence that will lead you to death. And these communities having higher rates of chronic illnesses. But that is in the same conversation of trying to survive in a world where young Black men, one of the leading causes of death for them is being killed by police. So 1 in 1,000 young Black men will die at the hands of police, which is sad and devastating.
Those property deeds, of course, are amazingly frank. And right. they pull no punches. There was apparently nothing considered wrong at all about herding people into certain neighborhoods. So the question is now, how do you undo the legacy of that? One of the things you brought up was the Georgetown neighborhood, mm-hmm. and that it actually becomes a medical problem. So explain that.
Yeah, so we look at Georgetown. The concentration of respiratory disease in King County is there in Georgetown and slightly further south in White Center. It becomes a very discrete medical issue because the choices of running I-5 through a poor neighborhood wasn't an accident, where you have high levels of manufacturing, big rigs that are driving through, that get to drive through the neighborhoods, and the particulates that are flying out of the trucks into the soil, where the children of our families are playing in the backyard, playing with the dirt, rubbing it on their face, maybe even putting it in their mouth, adding to the respiratory issues. Well, that child who may end up having asthma, which I did, walks into the clinic and our primary care provider, in their mind, believes that the only thing they can do is provide the prescription for asthma. And so the inhaler is given to them, they go back home and they use it. But we just sent that child right back into the situation that caused them to come into the hospital in the first place, and we're not actually addressing the root cause. Medicine can't stand in the silo of its clinic. It has to get out and actually advocate for the better health of our community. In much of our medical education, if you look at the major chronic illnesses, diabetes, hypertension, high blood pressure, The way it is taught to medical students, it starts off with, here are risk factors for those diseases. Risk factors suggest a pathology, meaning it suggests that if you have one of these risk factors, it will increase your likelihood of having the disease. Well, usually the number one risk factor for those chronic illnesses is race. Typically, it's Black and brown folks. And so it will say risk factor and it will say Black. And the question I have is, how is a phenotypical expression of the body of melanin the risk factor for a biological disease that is actually influenced and determined by the environment through which those people are experiencing the world? And why isn't racism the risk factor that leads to hypertension, high blood pressure, and a number of the other chronic illnesses? And it's because medicine hasn't wrestled with the reality that racism must be pathologized and must be the risk factor, not the person and their skin color.
So if we were being more rational about this, risk factors would have to include what? Address? Location of housing?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Zip code.
Zip code.
Zip code. Have you experienced racism? Do you have access to health care? It should be, do you have access to good transportation? Do you have a job? I mean, these are things that directly impact whether you will get the care you need to take care of that illness. A white man who didn't graduate from high school has a greater likelihood to live longer than a Black man who has a graduate degree by 5 years. That doesn't make sense when we say that, oh, well, it's all economic. I wish it was just economic, but it isn't. The research tells us that Black men who live to their mid-50s have potentially levels of PTSD equal to those who fought in the Vietnam War.
Just because of the way they've been treated.
Just because of the way they've been treated. But I do think we can address much of the issues if we do four basic things. If folks have good access to healthcare, if they have good access to an education, that they have a roof over their head, and that we don't have the type of policing that over-criminalizes certain communities to where we have a 2 million person prison population, we would have a fundamentally different health story that we would be telling.
Edwin Lindo is the Associate Director for Critical Teaching and Equity at the University of Washington's Center for Leadership and Innovation in Medical Education. You need a big door for a title that long, Edwin. And he also hosts the Praxis podcast, which is P-R-A-X-I-S, and you can find it just by Googling it. Thanks very much for coming on. I appreciate it.
David, appreciate you.
And that's just part of the 34-minute interview that we conducted. We put the whole thing up on the Ross Files. You can find that at mynorthwest.com. One of the consequences of the local protests is that Metro Transit has cut its ties with law enforcement. That means it will no longer shuttle officers to big events or protests. And Chris has been following this. Chris, give us what's the reason for it?
Well, if you read between the lines, you get the feeling that Metro and the brass in King County did not like the way that the police handled the situation, and they are basically cutting their ties with them. It's been a longstanding agreement that if law enforcement needed to move a large number of officers for any reason, Metro would provide out-of-service buses to shuttle them around. Usually happened for large planned events like marches or seafarer events. And during emergencies, Metro would help move officers where they needed to go to protect the region. Well, Metro General Manager Rob Gannon was on a call yesterday. I was listening and asking questions. He says the agency is dedicated to dismantling racism. And after considering the history of law enforcement in this country and what it represents to many of the people that Metro serves, it is no longer going to provide its buses to police.
We had been doing it at the outset of this series of civil demonstrations and peaceful protests because we understood that they were moving into place to help assure public safety. And then we readjusted our understanding and we ceased the practice.
A credible source has told Cairo Radio that King County Executive Dow Constantine actually called for this after watching the police response to the recent protests. In fact, that's why buses were not available to help move officers when they were losing the fight to hold the East Precinct. Police officers have told us that that actually hampered their response. Now, we're attempting to confirm this information as well independently. Now, if law enforcement needs to move a lot of people today, they're going to have to rent private buses, which cost about $12,000 a day for each one, and that will be paid for by the taxpayers.
Have we confirmed that it was Dow Constantine?
No, we have heard that from several, actually several credible people that we, you know, sources that we've used long time. And, you know, but we are doing some PDR requests to try to see if we can confirm that. Either way, the GM of Metro came out yesterday and basically said we didn't like what we saw. It doesn't represent our values. And so we're cutting our ties with the Seattle Police, State Patrol. Don't forget the King County Sheriff's Office provides Metro Transit cops, so they're under a different jurisdiction. But he said overall that he kept mentioning law enforcement, so that's kind of a general blanket over the entire law enforcement.
So, is there
community.
Some policy? I mean, what would change that? What would the police have to do to get back in Metro's good graces?
Probably nothing. At this point, it's pretty adamant. Now, if there is an emergency situation, a natural disaster, things like that, and the police need help with some shuttles and things like that, they can still go to the Office of Emergency Management, and then it'll be determined whether or not the Office of Emergency Management, who would be handling a catastrophic event like that, would grant or not grant that request to law enforcement at this point. It's just the kind of the handshake good neighbor policy that they've had over the last, forever is gone now.
Mm. In terms of the other problems facing Metro, that being revenue, where does that stand?
It's not good. Metro says it's going to lose $280 million in tax revenues this year alone, $615 million through 2021. Ridership continues to be way down, about 75%. So Metro plans to cut service in September to keep things afloat. So we're looking at 15% service reductions coming in the fall. Some routes that are out now because of COVID demand may never come back. And this comes as some routes are actually going to be returning to service on the 22nd as King County slowly reopens. GM Gannon told me that he believes that the riders will return, but only after they realize that bus travel is safe.
We have been trying to promote Metro as a safe service, that the cleanings that we instituted at the beginning of the pandemic outbreak are things that we're going to continue to do, that we are looking at ways of enhancing the perception and the actual safety on the coach.
It is considering adding protective shields around the drivers to prevent contact with customers. If that is successful, that means boardings at the front of the bus can then return again, which will help a little bit. However, the social distancing on buses will continue indefinitely, which greatly reduces the capacity of each bus. Metro is considering a return to fare collection around July 1st. And some good news for people in West Seattle. Water taxi service is going to resume on the 22nd. So will the shuttle buses that get people around to the dock. A second boat is actually being considered to add service to what is basically now a cut-off West Seattle.
Sullivan.
In the nation's northwest corner.
And every Friday morning, our resident historian Felix Spinell joins us for All Over the Map, a quick look at the stories behind the names of local places. And, of course, the latest local place name is Chaz, the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone, or your waiter at the Cheesecake Factory, whichever one you prefer. But, of course, this isn't the first time that a part of Seattle has been given a temporary protest name. So tell us about this, Felix.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've said a few times lately that we're living through history. It's almost like nothing from history compares with how compelling the present is right now. And regardless of how you might feel about the politics of it, I'm pretty sure the evolution of the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone is something that will be studied for decades. I mean, some of the earlier protest naming examples, we'll get to those in a moment. I wish we had the ability to track what we can track now in terms of the linguistic development. And, you know, adoption of local geographic names, I hope it's obvious by now, something I find fascinating. We learn so much about our cultural and social history from what we call places and why we call them that. And I don't know who named Chaz, but it's a clever name. It seemed to take less than a day to morph from a couple of variations. You know, Tuesday afternoon, I saw it called Cop Free Zone, Capitol Hill Free Zone, and finally the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone on Twitter. I saw a nationally trending Seattle Autonomous Zone, which made sense for people from far away. They don't care about Capitol Hill. They care that it's in Seattle. And the Wikipedia page was created just after midnight or early Wednesday morning by a wiki user who just added all this stuff to it. I'm not sure exactly when Chaz first emerged. I think it was late Tuesday, early Wednesday. I went up there myself to walk around and see. I saw all these bizarre signs for Free Capitol Hill and everything stenciled on the sidewalks. The feel of everything was kind of mellow, like a Grateful Dead concert in the early 80s. I went to a couple of those. Had that kind of sort of not quite festive feel, but it felt very mellow yesterday afternoon, of course. Now, some of these earlier names. During the Great Depression, Seattle had a number of what they called shack towns on previously vacant land in the city. the largest, wasn't far from where Starbucks is now, which is the old Sears building. And it was called Hooverville after President Hoover, who was in office when the Depression began and who was criticized for not doing more to shore up the economy. Hoovervilles were all over the U.S., but Seattle's was one of the largest. And there's also that homeless camp, better known these days as the Jungle, over on the edge of Beacon Hill by I-90. Mm-hmm. It was there during the Great Depression, too, and it was called by some Republican Heights, which is sort of a more generic slight to Hoover's party. And, you know, in Hooverville and Republican Heights and pretty much all the homeless encampments were gone by the early 40s. The authorities actually, you know, they didn't do sweeps. They just burned the camps down to make way for wartime use. And it was just, there was so much employment, the homeless camps pretty much evaporated by the early 40s. Now, in the summer of 34, there was a huge West Coast waterfront strike, very violent at times. And there was an encampment of strikers on Harbor Island that was called Smithville. This was named for one-term Seattle Mayor Charles L. Smith. He infamously ordered a series of crackdowns to break that strike, and he was called by various nicknames such as Tear Gas Smith and Machine Gun Smith. Now, in March 1970, Native Americans occupied part of the old Fort Lawton in Magnolia, and they quickly called themselves United Indians of All Tribes. And that name has stuck around for that organization that eventually built Daybreak Star there in what's now Discovery Park. In October of 1972, activists, who the newspaper described as Chicanos, occupied the vacant Beacon Hill School on Beacon Hill. Around November of 72, they renamed it El Centro de la Raza, which means the Center for the People of All Races. And that name and that organization is still going strong. Now, the most recent example I could find was in September of 2008, when activists and homeless people established a camp on the west side of the Duwamish, down near the First Avenue South Bridge, and they called it Nicholsville for the, you know, for then mayor, then Seattle Mayor Greg Nichols, who authorized sweeps of homeless camps earlier that year. This was a clear echo back to Hooverville. They were definitely using the Hooverville model for calling that Nicholsville, and that name still survives. There's tiny house villages, 22nd and Union, and at North Lake near Lake Union, and the residents are known by some as Nickelodeons. Now, I'd never heard that before until I looked up on the web, but one really bizarre side note, the original website for Nicholsville is now a listing for the top 10 dentists in Seattle. I don't know how that happened. But all these other names, these are sort of pre-social media era, and they were for mostly local things, and they stayed local. This Chaz name seems to be capturing the imagination of a lot of people, people in favor of it and people against it, because it's different from anything that's going on in the country right now. And it's really sort of drawing the focus of the president, and it's sort of different than all these other protests for some reason. And maybe that's just the Seattle way to find their own way to do something just slightly more bizarre than the rest of the country that gets all this attention.
Yeah, that's our market niche. Don't forget the Coleman School south of I-90, which was occupied for years and became the African-American Museum.
Yeah, and I was trying to find a name. I don't think they ever called that anything. I looked through the records and looked through the old newspaper archives to try to figure out what that group had called itself, and I couldn't find an actual name for that.
Yeah. Felix Bunnell, all his features are at MyNorthwest.com. Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Dave.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. And from time to time, we check with Dr. Keith Jerome, who is director of the UW Virology Lab, to get the latest diagnosis on our national pandemic here. And as cities and states begin to reopen around the country, have you noticed, well, I know there's been an increase in the spread, but can you tell me what are the factors behind that?
Well, Dave, you know, you're seeing more and more people out. I mean, there's so many things going on, right? The restaurants are opening and stores are opening in different paces around the country. And of course, we've seen a tremendous number of people gathering for these protests. So, you know, there are places where cases are going up. They're maybe not going up as fast as, you know, we worried about a worst case scenario might be. So I think that's good. I think people do know how to be careful in these situations, and that's great. So people are still generally doing the right thing, keeping the distance between themselves and wearing the masks and washing hands. So we've got to keep a close eye on this, but I'm cautiously optimistic that we're sort of treading the path appropriately.
And this report that we can expect another wave in September, can you give us a feel for what that would look like?
Well, that's a big unknown, what that's going to be. But we all know, you don't have to be a virologist to know that September, October, November, you get into the colder seasons, people are indoors more, there's just more respiratory infections, right? You're more likely to get a cold, you're more likely to get the flu. Coronaviruses typically show some seasonality like that. There's more infections in the wintertime. You think about what happened early on this year, right? We went from sort of no cases to a shocking number of cases really, really quickly. if we're starting from a higher baseline as we go into those winter months, if we let our guard down, we could have a wave that's bigger than what we saw. That said, I think people are going to do the right thing and keep taking the precautions. So I hope we don't see that. But it is going to depend completely on what people do and how people keep their behaviors careful.
Now, can you explain the somewhat confusing World Health Organization news conference where at first they said, well, asymptomatic spread is not that much of a problem, and then they walked it back right away? I mean, what was going on there?
You know, we use this term asymptomatic. That means different things in different contexts. Clearly it means not having symptoms, but there are people who can be spreading the virus and don't have symptoms today. They don't have symptoms yet, but they start to have symptoms tomorrow. But they're infectious today, and so they can spread that virus. So to speak precisely, we might call that pre-symptomatic shedding, a pre-symptomatic transmission. And that definitely can happen. I mean, there's many, many papers showing that. Estimates are about 40% of transmission is probably coming from people who are making a lot of virus, but they don't feel bad yet. So they're out living their normal everyday life. And if they're not being careful, they can spread the virus. There's that. And there's also, you can start to split hairs. There's minimally symptomatic situations where people are really hardly sick at all, but they still have virus. And once you figure out they've got the virus, then you can start to ascribe maybe that little scratchy throat, or, you know, they sneezed a time or two, or, you know, I had a headache. You know, maybe that was COVID, but they just didn't have much symptoms, but they can still transmit. What I think this shows you is that contact tracing is difficult. You know, looking at, you know, a few tens of contacts and not finding one doesn't mean it never happens. It just means you're not looking at the right people yet. We've talked about this. You know, this is hard. Science is tough. Studies sometimes contradict each other a little bit, and we have to do more studies and understand why. And it typically has to do with the way they were done, or sometimes just bad luck or data is misinterpreted. And, you know, science needs a little bit of time to figure this out. But we can't just focus on the latest study, you know, because it happens to contradict everything we've known from before. And that sort of was the case here.
So wearing masks is still a good idea.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they're not perfect. That's for sure. They help a lot. And the likelihood of transmission is a kind of a math question about how much virus is being coughed out or spread. How close are you to it? How deeply are you breathing? How susceptible are you? And then at the end of all that, just a couple of coin flips to see whether you're lucky or not. And so, you know, it's a tough business. And so what we're always trying to do is minimize that risk, and it never gets down to zero. And I think hopefully people are going to understand that. And, you know, that is, you know, philosophically, that is also life, that is not risk free. We're trying to make it so that you can do these things with a reasonable assumption of coming out of it healthy.
Right. All right. And finally, what's the status of testing? Are all the free testing centers up and running?
Wow, they sure are, and they seem to be really a hit. They're doing incredibly well. You might have seen they're actually trying to hire more folks to work there and help. There's so much demand to take more samples and so forth. So it's really fantastic. It's kept our lab really busy. The last 2 days have been the busiest 2 days we've had ever for testing. We've tested over 3,700 samples yesterday. And the other nice thing is that we're seeing is that the positivity rate has been pretty low, kind of in the 2% or so range, sometimes a little even lower than that. So it means, you know, we're testing a lot of people, which is what we want. And to control the virus in the context of a population, you really want that positivity rate to be down there around 1% or 2%. That's sort of your target. You're testing a lot of people with a low threshold for concern, and then you're hopefully finding most of those people who actually have the infection. You're finding them early so that you stop this spread that we were talking about of the virus.
Okay, so what you're finding from this extensive testing is that the infection rate is just about 2%?
Well, people who show up for testing. So some people are people who are sick and have shown up in the hospital and they go, I think I have COVID. And they're obviously more likely to actually have this. So if you lump everything together that we're testing, it's about 2% of people are positive.
Right.
So,
well, it seemed to me, well, tell me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me that since, of course, people who have symptoms are more likely to seek out a test, if anything, that 2% rate is going to be high, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, if we just go around and start testing people randomly on the street, it's surely well below that. So, no, I'm not saying by any means that 2% of us in Western Washington have COVID.
Yeah. Dr. Keith Jerome directs the UW Virology Lab. Keith, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Dave. Take care.
It's time for the Daily Dose of Kindness now, sponsored by Mike Novak and listwithnovak.com. In the aftermath of looters disrupting peaceful protests in Buffalo, New York, Antonio Gwynn Jr. thought, there was only one thing to do here. We saw it in Seattle, too. Grab a broom, grab some trash bags, and get to work cleaning up his neighborhood. He cleaned, he says, for 10 hours, starting at 2 a.m. In fact, another group had organized and came along to clean up themselves, but found Antonio alone, had already done most of the work himself. Well, WKBW-TV says word spread and caught the attention of Matt Block, who had a shiny red 2004 Ford Mustang collecting dust, probably, in his driveway. Fact is, he wasn't driving it. And he got an idea.
I couldn't come to grips with selling it. And this was a good way for me to get rid of it and know someone that gets it is going to appreciate it, I think.
He decided to give the car to Antonio. He found Antonio on Facebook. He set up the handoff. And Antonio, poof, he was in shock.
Like, it doesn't feel real. It seems like this is like a movie just going on.
And then word spread of the cleanup further. And the car got around to local businessman Bob Briceland, who owns an insurance company. He offered Gwen free insurance on that car for an entire year.
I just felt compelled to help him out. And just, we need to get together, our whole city, and show people how there's so many good people here.
The good news kept coming in, too. After hearing Antonio's story, a college in Buffalo offered him a full scholarship. So he's got a car. He's got insurance. Now he has a scholarship to attend college. Antonio says that news took him over the top.
Stopped, pulled over, and then I started crying. So did my great aunt. And my little cousin did also.
He plans to study business starting this fall so he can start his own repair shop.
I always wanted to just be someone that can help everyone with their car problems. So this is like a great opportunity that I have right in front of me.
Says all this good fortune has really affected him. He's already started to pay it forward as well. But boy, I say, Antonio, you did your job cleaning up your neighborhood. That was out of the goodness of your heart. And there's always people out there looking to reward that kind of kindness.
That's good to hear. Now from the G and Ursula Show, weekdays 9 to noon. G. Scott, it's been a quiet few weeks in terms of Seahawks news. but if the news isn't related to viruses or protests, we don't cover it. Until somebody asked Coach Carroll about Colin Kaepernick. And I guess let me play these cuts then, G. The Seahawks had brought him in. Well, just run us of the history of this.
The history is we all know Colin Kaepernick and what his stance was about, and I'm glad today it's more clear than ever. Well, during that time when he did not re-sign with the San Francisco 49ers, he was a free agent. And of all the 32 teams, the Seattle Seahawks were the first team to reach out to Colin Kaepernick and actually bring him in for an interview. He interviewed with Pete Carroll, John Snyder, and, of course, also got to talk to those inside of the building as well. And, of course, Pete Carroll talks about that in the interview, and he has some regrets.
Him taking a knee or whatever, that never even came up in our conversations. That was never even an issue for us. I always felt like Cap was the kind of guy that was a starting quarterback, like I said way back then. Had we had that opportunity, it would have been possibly a great fit with us.
Hmm. So, but wouldn't that have been awkward, considering they already had a starting quarterback?
They do. I mean, Russell Wilson is that quarterback. And like Pete Carroll is saying in that interview, he talks about the fact that Colin Kaepernick came to the building, and Pete talks about how he was blown away and how those inside of the building was blown away, and talking about he, you know, far reached over his expectations of, oh, this Colin Kaepernick guy, man, this is going to be a good quarterback. Now, you got to remember, the Seattle Seahawks were the first team. So when the Seahawks did not sign him, I would assume the understanding is oh, somebody's for sure going to sign him. If you would have told me then that the Seattle Seahawks would be the only team to bring Colin Kaepernick for an interview, I wouldn't have believed you. But that's what history has showed us. I don't think Pete Carroll and the Seahawks knew. I don't think all of us listening right now knew that the Seahawks would be the only team to bring him in for an interview, into their building. So right now on social media, you have some who don't believe Pete Carroll. Why would Pete Carroll lie in this situation? Again, he brought him in for the interview. I don't think any of us thought that that would be the only interview that Colin Kaepernick would have with the NFL team during that time.
And just a football aside, G, because I don't understand why you wouldn't want a starter quality quarterback to be your backup quarterback. I don't understand passing up somebody who could be just as effective as Russell Wilson if that player is willing to sign.
Well, I don't know the technical reasons as to why Pete Carroll didn't do it. But I want to speak to this. This is my opinion right here, okay? When you start talking about football, and the one position on the team that fans always, for some reason, have some kind of little love for is the backup quarterback. Mm-hmm. Right? The backup quarterback's always like, hey, give this guy a shot. Give him a chance. So when you start talking about Russell Wilson during that time, this is before, I mean, Russell Wilson is a great quarterback. He was a great quarterback then. He's even greater now. But Russell Wilson was still growing into the player that he is. Let's just say, hypothetically, that the Seahawks did sign Colin Kaepernick during that time. Colin Kaepernick, who has gone to the Super Bowl before, who has beat the Seahawks before, who we all know at one point in time, Colin Kaepernick was a really good quarterback. So let's just say Russell stumbles and the Seahawks don't do well. Sometimes what would that energy bring? Then you have people saying, hey, bring in the backup quarterback. Give Colin Kaepernick a chance. So now you change the entire dynamic. Again, I'm not saying this is what Pete Carroll said. This is my opinion.
So you think it would have made Russell look over his shoulder?
I just think it just changes the conversation both in the quarterback room and in the locker room. And amongst us fans, we fans say, well, I think Colin Kaepernick would do a better job right here. Or I think that, I mean, when is the last time?
You have to make a business decision on hurt feelings, though.
You say what?
It seems strange to me that Pete Carroll or the Seahawks would make a business decision, having an effective player on your team, because of potential hurt feelings.
This ain't about, no, Colleen, this ain't about hurt feelings. This is about winning games.
Right. But you're saying that maybe they passed up on him because fans would talk ill of Russell Wilson or Russell Wilson. That's what I got from it.
That's not what I'm saying. Okay. There's also chemistry in locker rooms. There's also the job of Pete Carroll is to win games. It's not necessarily for the opinion on how things are done. When Pete Carroll first came to the Seattle Seahawks, let's be real. Not a lot of people were excited about Pete Carroll when he first got there, including people that were there at the building. The first time that music was being played at practice, nobody thought that was a good idea. I even knew players that thought that it was the dumbest idea in the world to play music at practice. Guess what, y'all? Every team in the NFL now plays music at practice. So going back to Pete Carroll, his job is to win games, and I think the decisions that those guys made is what's best for the team at that time. That was the decision. It had nothing to do with any other of hurt feelings or anything like that with fan bases.
G. Scott with Ursula, 9 o'clock on Kyle Radio. Thanks, G. Yep. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you'll never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.